Thank you for seeing me today, Father.
How can I help you, child?
I'm having a crisis of faith.
Doubt is just a pothole on the road to faith. Believe in things, and you shall have them. What is the nature of your crisis, child?
Father, I can't believe. It's not butter.
Apostate! You shall roast in the flaming safflower oil of Lucifer!
Please, Father!
I'm sorry, child. It's just believing it's not butter, even though it seems for all the world like butter, is the essence of faith. What the Bible calls prayer, thou can spreadest on thy toast.
How can I begin the road back to spiritual wholeness?
How about, gee, your hair smells terrific.
Thank you. You know, I don't even wash my hair all the time because it's locked and...
No. Gee, your hair smells terrific is the name of a shampoo.
I don't understand.
You're deluded and full of doubt. Look inside yourself and see the place where it's not butter.
It's not butter. It's not butter. It's not butter.
Yes.
But what if it is?
Get out!
See, this is why the church is losing followers. Let's get ready for a show about what really is butter. And now he injured himself trying to act out both parts in Last Tango in Paris, Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about that part of the butter story today. At least I don't think so. I hope not, actually. But anyway, yes, I can't believe it's not butter. I've always believed that I can't believe it's not butter and gee, your hair smells terrific are kind of linked products somehow. They're the only complete sentence products I can think of. But we're not talking about shampoo today either. We're talking about butter. This is our salute to, our tribute to butter. Joining us in studio, we're so lucky we have, I mean, really, the person who did write the Bible of Butter, Elaine Kosrova, author of Butter, A History, a former pastry student at the Culinary Institute of America, and a former test kitchen editor at Country Living Magazine. Why did you write a book about butter? Why is it just as a chef, as a cook, you felt that strongly?
Well, the short answer is that one did not exist. Someone had to write a book about butter. But I really was inspired actually by the science and craft of butter making. Because before I wrote this book, I was the editor of a cheese magazine called Culture. It's a national cheese magazine. It's still out there. Mm-hmm. And so I was behind the scenes in the dairy world a lot for about 5 years, and I was trying different kinds of butter. They were higher fat. Some were whey butters, cultured butters. Some were waxy, and some were greasy, and some were sweeter than others. And I was really kind of astonished, like, butter is essentially one ingredient, cream, I thought, you know, give or take salt. And so, you know, what was going on here? Why was I seeing such nuances in the butter world? And so I started to delve into the craft and science, and that kind of naturally led me down the path of history. And then I was like, wow, I can't believe the impact that butter has had on cultures around the world and vice versa, cultures impacting butter and butter making. So I went out to get a book on butter, and there wasn't one. So,
So first of all, I want to talk about that history. So before there's history, there's butter, right? I mean, Neolithic people.
Stone Age butter.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. We'll never know the exact year, time. You know, we're talking at least 10,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. So if you follow the domestication of animals, mm-hmm. that's where you see the butter trail begin.
So we're talking about like yak or something like that? We're not talking about cow, probably.
We're not talking about cow because they were one of the last animals to be domesticated. So yak, goat, sheep, probably more likely goat and sheep. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the Tibetan plateau area and the kind of herding that was happening there even 15,000 years ago, it's likely there was yak butter very early on.
And I mean, you know, you posit a couple of theories in the book. I mean, basically what we're talking about is the shaking of a dairy product, right? Somehow or other.
Yeah, there's agitation.
Yeah.
That's all you need is agitation. And we surmise that the earliest butters, butters were made actually by accident. Probably the shepherd was carrying the milk. It would have been whole milk, mm-hmm. very kind of naturally cultured, a little fermented, in an animal sack, perhaps on his back or perhaps on the back of a mule or something. So it's rocking back and forth as he's going up and down, you know, the paths, the valleys. And lo and behold, he opens the sack, and there are these beautiful golden, well, in the case of goat and sheep, they would have still been white. They wouldn't have been golden pieces of butter, but still they would have been these morsels, these rich, delicious morsels of fat.
They wouldn't have been gold because there wouldn't be beta carotene in...
It has to do with the way the animals store beta carotene. Mm-hmm. So in cows, the animals store beta carotene, which transfers to the milk, which transfers to the butter. Whereas in sheep and goats, the animals convert beta carotene to vitamin A, and that goes into the milk, and vitamin A is colorless.
Right. So actually, when you answer the question, which some people may be thinking right now, why is milk white and butter yellow if you don't add anything? Mm-hmm. You essentially answer also the question of what is butter, right? Butter is things that were formerly separate coming together.
Yes. Yes. Well, you have the fat, and butter is the fat that's in milk, and it's invisible until you agitate it.
And you break little membranes when you're agitating it, right?
Exactly. That's really the whole goal of agitation in butter making, whether you're using a food processor or a giant industrial machine. There's all these little tiny membranes that cloak the fat molecules, and you want to break those. And that causes the fats to come together, coalesce.
Now, I want to talk about some of the – well, let's get right to it because I think this stuff is fascinating. So there's lots of very primal foods, but it's hard to think of another primal food that has had other uses besides eating and uses connected to sacrament and to art as much as is the case of butter. So I think we have to get into that a little bit. Let's just pick an example. I mean, I happen to have spent a lot of time hanging around with Tibetan monks for some reason in my life, but I never saw them do the butter sculpture. Mm-hmm. Talk about the Tibetan butter sculpture.
Mm. Yes. So that's one example of how butter has been used, and this is universally, especially in the ancient times, as a tool for worship and for ritual. Mm-hmm. So I saw this in my research. You know, the Tibetans are one example, and that's a really great example because it continues today, Tibetan butter sculpting. But I do want to make the point that there were other cultures doing similar kinds of rituals using butter. The Tibetans, Tibetan Buddhists, they make what's called tormas. These are sculptures that I guess you're familiar with, Colin, right? You've seen them. So they can be small, they can be large. They're made out of butter, which is mixed with flour generally to make a paste. And in Tibet, they would be naturally colored with plant pigments. But generally today, because so many of the Tibetan monks are exiled to southern India, they're using butter mixed with margarine, mixed with wax, things that are a little more...
They're in hotter places, right?
Right, yeah. So, and they also use oil pigments, you know, paint pigments. But the practice is the same. The idea is to create this gorgeous sculpture that becomes part of their altar that can represent numerous deities, depending on what the intention is of the prayer or the prayer festival. And some of these are just absolutely stunning. They're like we would equate it with totem poles, but they're not meant to last. It's part of the Buddhist practice to create these sculptural pieces that will eventually dissipate. Because of course that's the tenet of Buddhism that things do not last forever.
Right. Same with the sand mandala.
Right.
Ultimately,
yeah,
they
exactly.
sweep it away and erase it
and
scatter it.
Yeah, incredible detail like that.
Right.
It's really mind-blowing. Yeah.
That's sort of the ultimate Tibetan concept, right? This incredibly painstaking thing. I mean, these butter sculptures, I don't think we could possibly convey to anybody how elaborate and painstaking they are. Something that takes a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
Same with the mandalas. And then it's gone.
There is a film called Torma that tells you all about it and shows you what we're talking about here. Really beautiful.
Now, some of this has to do with butter probably being imbued a little bit with some sacramental or sacrosanct ideas, right? There's a way in which butter and religion connect. Butter's in the Bible, for example.
Mm. Yeah, butter's in the first meal that's cited in the Bible because Abraham was serving a meal to three people he thought were the angels. So it's mentioned there. It's also was used by the Vedic Aryans. These are the ancestors of modern-day Hindus. And they worshipped a fire god named Agni, and they would take butter, probably in the form of ghee, so that's melted, clarified butter, and they would sprinkle it on the flames so that they would crackle and dance and leap, and all the while they would be reciting verses to Agni, the fire god. I actually have some of these verses in my book. People want to recreate that ritual. So that's one. Also, if we look way back, 2500 BC, the Sumerians also used to bring butter as a gift to their goddess Inanna. They would bring it to the temple because Inanna was married to a mythical dairy shepherd. And the people wanted to help this shepherd, her husband, keep her in dairy riches, which was the promise he made to her, that she would always have lots of dairy because she loved it. So people would regularly bring butter to the temples in Samaria.
Some of this is connected somehow or other to ritualistic ideas about fecundity for a whole bunch of reasons, including, as you
fertility.
You point out in the book, if you even think about sort of how butter is made, the physical process and by which butter is made. I don't think I need to put a point on that one. You get the idea. There's like an obvious connection right away as to why that would be. We should actually mention one other group of people who clearly had some kind of relationship to butter that was probably votive in nature, and that would be Druids inhabiting Ireland and other northern European areas like that where there are bogs, right?
Yes.
Tell us about bog butter.
Yeah, bog butter. So these are batches of butter that are either packed into a wooden cask or sometimes wrapped in linen, sometimes in moss. And these were buried in the bog over millennia. So up to the present day, we have found about 450 samples of bog butter that have been unearthed as men are harvesting the peat in Ireland. So it's pretty much by accident that we find these. And so what we have believed for a long time was that the ancient peoples who buried these butters did it to preserve the butter because, of course, the peat is great for preserving just about anything. It's very acidic. It's anaerobic. It's cool. You can actually put bodies in there and they'll be preserved for a very long time. So we think that part of the reason butter was packed and buried in the bog was preservation. But what's interesting, I found in my research that they've kind of mapped out where they found all these hundreds of samples of bog butter. And they correlate with these kind of sacred boundaries in the sort of elemental world, the so-called fairy world. So we're pretty certain that many of these bog butters were offerings to the elementals, to the fairies, to appease them, because, of course, the fairies were responsible for all kinds of mischief in people's lives.
Right. I just like to tell you, Elaine, that it's the policy of our show that we don't put air quotes around fairy world or say... And we don't say so-called fairy world.
Okay, right.
Show.
Good.
So, yeah. So, I mean, it seems, I mean, the fact that these can be found suggests that they had a votive purpose because otherwise, I mean, otherwise you'd have a druid brand of butter called I Forgot Where I Put My Butter. But people don't forget where they put their butter. It's too valuable. So chances are they just intended it for it to be never.
Absolutely.
Okay, we speed ahead to pre-Renaissance, Renaissance. We're starting to see their representations of women. There's a way in which this is sort of now connected to a certain kind of femininity, both in art, poetry, everything like that. So say a little about that.
Well, I do have, first of all, I just want to back up a tiny bit to say that my book has 10 chapters and only one of them, the 10th, is about the culinary value of butter, which is not to diminish that at all, but to, you know, to give people a sense of the scope of butter's history. So yes, I spent a lot of time reading about the life of dairymaids. I was astonished, actually, first off, to find out that women really founded the dairy world because universally it was taboo for men to have anything to do with dairying, with the cows, with milking, with processing milk. That was all associated closely with birth and fertility and lactation. It was very much a female domain, unlike it is today. So that was pretty remarkable in itself. And, you know, then as I learned more about how these women lived and how they worked, and of course, you know, they worked very hard. They had cows they had to milk every single day and process that milk every day because, of course, there was no refrigeration and things, you know, had to move along. But so it was arduous work. But because it was their domain and they controlled it, and men honestly didn't really understand how you could take liquid milk, bring it into the creamery, and it comes out in solid form later. They didn't really understand this transformation until men invaded the dairy around, you know, the 1800s. But so women had quite a measure of status and respect, dairy women in particular, based on their skill and based on the fact that the butter and cheese that they made was very valuable. So this was something that women took a lot of pride in. You can see that when you look at some of the butter molds, the exquisite, beautiful butter molds that women used to use to market their butter better. You know, it was a degree of entrepreneurship that was unusual back in the day.
Also, butter is something that lends itself, although we don't maybe think about that much these days, to connoisseurship in the sense that, like wine, it has a terroir, right? There's a way in which that one, even, I mean, that one person's butter output at the level you're talking about in that time of history would taste and look and feel a little bit different from somebody else's.
Oh, yes, very much so, because it was much harder to make butter then. Without refrigeration, without these sanitation controls that we have today, to get a pure, clean, fresh, beautiful butter. Well, it would have all been cultured, actually, back in the day. It wasn't really fresh butter. Would have been cultured butter. So, yeah, no, there was quite a lot of skill involved in making a beautiful butter.
Yeah. I want to come back to the cultured butter thing, but probably maybe towards the end of the show when we're talking about artisanal butter, because I think that's an important thing. So just because it's so classically a French bourbon excess, we should talk about Marie Antoinette's dress up and play butter maid situation. What was going on there? What was that?
Yeah, well, at Versailles, she had a little village built, a recreation of a beautiful country village on the grounds of Versailles called Hameau. And within that tiny village, she had what's called a laiterie d'agrément, a pleasure dairy. There was actually two dairies. So the pleasure dairy was where she would go to sort of make believe she was a dairy maid, along with all her ladies in waiting. And it was, you know, sort of their little dairy playhouse, although quite elaborate. I mean, it was marble fixtures and gold and porcelain tools, really quite exquisite. But right beside that, there was a practical dairy where the actual real dairy women made the things that would then be served in the pleasure dairy. So this was really an ornament as part of her, you know, her grounds, her garden. But it was a place she really liked to gather, I think, because she felt, you know, again, the dairy is a female domain. This represents her identity. It represents power for women, not her per se, but, you know.
That would be my guess, because of all the things that you said before about why men were almost a little afraid of the dairy realm. But that's because power could reside there, and it was connected to all these sort of basic female functions. So you don't want to become so rarefied if you're Marie Antoinette that you have no connection to this very visceral realm of butter and milk, right?
And yet she was criticized for this pleasure dairy and the second one that was built for her, which she actually didn't get to enjoy because of the French Revolution. But she was criticized because it wasn't real world and it was extravagant and it didn't reflect the true nature of hardworking dairy people. Whereas Caterina de' Medici, 200 years early, she also had a pleasure dairy. But in her case, people thought it represented her stewardship of the land, and they lauded the fact that she had it. So it was interesting. Marie Antoinette was just not liked.
I think Steve Mnuchin and his wife are starting a pleasure dairy, but I don't have that. That's not a solid news item. So very quickly, we're going to go into break, and we're going to talk about another aspect of all this. But before we do, I mean, we have to sort of do the men ruin everything moment where the Industrial Revolution happens. And first of all, men take this thing from women that has been their province for a long time, mm-hmm. but they don't preserve a lot of the qualities that we're talking about.
No, no. In fact, they dismissed so much of just the knowledge that women had in their fingertips, in their senses. They wanted to systematically go through the process, you know, and very much make it a business and not an art, as mm-hmm. women had made it for so many years, for so long.
And you know, I was going to wait for the artisanal part, but I'm going to bring it up now. So mm-hmm. there's this Swiss theorist that I'm obsessed with named Clotaire Rapaille, who gets hired occasionally, used to get hired by big companies to try to help them market their products to people who never bought them before. And one of the things that he eventually had to tell the Kraft people, mm-hmm. and this is about cheese, but I'm betting the truth is about butter, is that Europeans, specifically the French, but Europeans probably in general in Western Europe, you know, they see cheese. Americans tend to like things to be sterile mm-hmm. and inert and kind of dead when you eat it, you know, whereas Europeans, when they think about cheese, and I'm sure about butter, too, see it as kind of alive. I mean, a culture butter, it is alive. Yeah. You know, it's alive. You put it on the table. It sits on the table for a while. It's like a little member of the family. The cat walks across it. You know, it's fine. You know, it's all sort of. It's part of your biome almost, right? So,
yes.
And I'm assuming that that's one of the things that gradually got lost, at least in the real fast-paced industrialization of butter eventually.
Particularly in the U.S.
Yeah.
Not as much, as you said, in Europe because they had an appreciation, and they obviously still do. But we're just kind of rediscovering that aspect of food, the aliveness of food that can...
Right.
That can be really right. actually good for us and also delicious.
Right. No, some of us are anyway.
Yes.
And meanwhile, of course, mm-hmm. as we're having this conversation, I haven't heard any late breaking bulletins about this, but France, last I knew, was in the grip of at least a butter panic, if not a butter shortage. A
yes.
burr out, as they say, right?
Yes, yes. I actually wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about that because on the surface, it looks like a price war, and it very much is between the distributors and the retailers in France.
Mm-hmm.
And part of why you saw so many empty shelves of in France, no butter, was because people knew this was coming, this conflict mm-hmm. and this standoff, and they rushed to the store and bought
right.
butter. So there actually is butter in France. There was butter at the time. But the retailers refused to pay the price that the distributors wanted to pay,
mm-hmm.
Wanted them to pay, because now the distributors can get a lot more for their butter in the global market. You
right.
know, China wants butter now, and Saudi Arabia wants butter. All these places that have not been butter countries ever are discovering how fabulous it is. So prices have gone up in France. My piece actually was about tied into actually climate change and how that has an impact on
mm-hmm.
butter and butter prices.
Yep. Mm-hmm. All right. So we're talking about butter right now with Elaine Kostrova. Now we're going to add another voice to our conversation. We're going to turn our gaze to the Midwest, to specifically Wisconsin, where if the Green Bay Packers fans were not cheeseheads, they would probably be butterheads. But butter on your head, I don't know. Somehow or other, it's a... stickier.
They put Nepal.
Yeah.
They put better on their head in
better
Nepal.
Than heads? Okay.
Yeah.
So that's apparently the fans of Nepal's mm-hmm. classic football team. they do that. All right. We're going to talk about the margarine wars, too. We will take a break, and we will come back.
You'll squish it between your fingers and squish it between your toes. I'm talking butter. Just a little on your nose. Is it with that butter?
What is your area of expertise?
Well, I can tell the difference between butter and I can't believe it's not butter.
No, you can't, Mr. Simpson. No one can.
Well, that may or may not be true. But so we're talking about butter right now. This is our whole show. This is kind of a salute to butter. Elaine Kostrova is with me here in studio. She's the author of Butter. A history.
A rich history.
Oh, yes, a rich history. Oh, I'm missing that part. A rich history. And she is a former pastry student at Culinary Institute of America, former test kitchen editor at Country Living Magazine. Now joining us by, well, actually, before we get to Doug, you're going to meet the person who Like if there were a Pulitzer specifically given out in margarine journalism, would win every year, basically, for many, many years. But before we get there, let's just talk about how margarine arrives on the scene. And Elaine, it does have something to do with Napoleon, as so many things do.
Well, Napoleon III.
Napoleon III.
Yes.
Okay.
So we're talking about around the 1860s here.
Mm-hmm.
But he had an army, of course, and he wanted a cheaper substitute to than butter to feed his army, something cheaper and also something that traveled well for his army. He was actually planning a battle. And so he put out word of a contest, a prize for someone who could figure out a butter substitute for his troops. And a chemist came along and produced this mixture of beef fat and milk and a little bit of salt and food coloring. And that was actually the origins of the first margarine. So he won the prize and it was fairly successful, although the troops ended up not going to Prussia, not going to war after all. But we were left with this foundational substance that became margarine. Nothing like the margarine today, of course, which is made with vegetable oil, but that's really how it got its start.
All right. So now we do add Doug Moe, a Wisconsin-based author and journalist who has written for newspapers and magazines for almost 40 years. Today is a very tough day in Wisconsin. The Packers have been mathematically eliminated from playoff contention. So he's very brave to come on the show today. He could just be lying on the floor in a fetal position with everybody else in Wisconsin. So Doug, welcome to the show. So in Wisconsin, which is obviously a heralded dairy state, margarine, at least, well, margarine for quite some time has been regarded as sort of a nefarious interloper. What did Wisconsin do about that?
Well, dating back to the 1800s, it was actually illegal to sell margarine in Wisconsin. And that sort of culminated in the 1960s when some more enlightened, if you would, legislators decided to try to pass a bill that would allow it. And one in particular, state senator, was just up in arms and considered this a travesty that they would even think about allowing margarine sales here. And so there then came an instance of him trying it in the Capitol. But before that happened, there was actually, contraband. There would be people would actually make runs across the state line to Minnesota or Illinois and come back with margarine.
Right.
And people got busted.
Right.
I wrote a column about it back in early in the 20th century. A guy from the city of Janesville here in Wisconsin got 18 months in federal prison for selling it.
That was A.E. Graham. And I feel like that must have been hard to be in prison and people say, what are you in for? You know, running margarine?
Right. You know, if I was inclined to cut these folks any slack, which I'm not, I would make some sort of argument of like you guys were talking about France earlier, and how, you know, to make wine you have to be called a certain kind of wine, you have to do it
right
in a certain way, or down in Kentucky, I think the same for sour mash or bourbon. So, I think that was part of it because clearly dairy is huge here. But it got to the point of being ridiculous, you know, but that never stopped the legislature.
So you've had a form of prohibition there. I think it was tried a little bit maybe in other parts of the country. I mean, look, it makes sense that you can't sell yellow oleomargarine and say it's butter. That's
right.
Fraud, but it's prohibiting the existence of it. And so, Elaine, you know, one of the ironies of margarine, I think, is that everything we sort of thought was good for us we were probably mistaken about. So back when it was made out of beef fat, it was probably better for us
better
than this.
For us. Yeah, that's the irony of moving toward vegetable oils, which sounds so benign, but when you hydrogenate those vegetable oils and change their natural fat structure, you create trans fats, and we all know that's a very bad thing.
Well, the other reason that margarine, Elaine, got a foothold was World War II, right? Where,
yes,
first of all,
butter shortages.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, there were you know, there were not as many men to work the farms, so there was less dairy production, and what butter there was generally went to the army. So there was a lot of rationing of butter and margarine, actually, as well. People had ration coupons for both of those things, and butter was harder to come by than margarine then, for sure.
And, you know, Doug, we have to go back to that epic moment that you were referring to in the Wisconsin legislature, where there really was a challenge to one of the great prohibitionists, one of the great anti-margarine prohibitionists, a state senator, who was blindfolded and challenged to tell the difference. And what did happen on that day?
Yeah, his name was Gordon Roselip, and he was infamous in the state, very conservative guy. He had resisted a bridge being built from Iowa across a river from Iowa to Wisconsin, saying that it would help keep the Russians out if they didn't build the bridge. So that was sort of his mindset. But anyway, yeah, he said oleomargarine was tasted awful and was greasy and this and that. And so they organized a test for him. And you can just imagine the drum roll sort of thing. And he tastes it, and he says, "That's oleo." And of course, it was butter. He had blown it, and it wasn't until years later I tracked down his daughter when I was writing about this, 6 or 7 years ago, and it turned out that the Roselip family, they lived in Southwest Wisconsin, had actually gone across the border surreptitiously, not told the patriarch, because he weighed 270 pounds, and they were worried about it. And sure enough, they brought margarine back and served it to him and said it was butter. So when he stood up in the state capitol and you know, made his identification for what he had been eating, he was right.
Right.
He had thought, right.
Yeah. He'd been
duped
for a while.
Yeah.
So if it strikes you that this might make a really good movie, something like this, something would be as crazy as this, well, we have to tell you that there is a movie called Margarine Wars, a 2011 comedy by David Rich about a kosher Jew who dupes a Swedish dairy farmer into smuggling illegal margarine into butter-sensitive Wisconsin. The sheriff, played by Gene Marola, I think you hear him in this scene, is confronting a smuggler when he sees margarine leaking from the trunk.
You see that sign? You're in Wisconsin now. And if I'm not mistaken, this stuff leaking from the trunk of your car is that non-udder butter, or what you Illinoisans call margarine. And margarine is illegal here in Wisconsin. Why? It's full of that mono or monodiclicarides. And that's just one molecule away from plastic. And you know what's in diclicarides? Insects! And you know where butter comes from? Cows. Cows are good. Insects are bad. We got a lot of cows here. We got so much butter, it's coming out of our... Well, let's just say we got a lot of butter.
All right. So that's I don't even know what to say after that, except that, Doug, you know, we might think that all of this madness is over, but it's not entirely over. For example, there's a woman who still crosses the state line to get Kerrygold butter, which comes from Ireland. I mean, how can that be in 2017 that you'd have to cross state lines to get some kind of forbidden butter?
Well, because there's a law in the books that you can't sell butter manufactured out of the United States. So the Irish butter is contraband here.
Right. It has to be graded through a U.S. process, right? It has to go through a grading?
I believe that's it. And again, I think it just there's history there, and the fact that the legislature, whenever something comes up to overturn some of this stuff, they say we got more important things to do. I think that's the reason. It does make us look kind of silly.
No, not at all.
Well, I just want to.
Yeah, go ahead, Elaine.
I just want to add that, you know, there was a 90-year-long margarine butter battle in the legislatures, and in many states. So it wasn't just Wisconsin. Wisconsin has held on, but there were many other states who were criminalizing margarine in the manufacture of it. And, you know, the margarine producers tried to work around so many of these, you know, restrictions. Color was the big thing, right? And it was interesting on my book tour how many Americans remember, these are older Americans, remember getting white oleo in a plastic package with a little capsule of yellow that then they would squeeze. That was usually their job if they were the kids in the family. Squeeze that capsule of yellow into this white substance. And the kids really thought they were making butter then. Yeah. I thought that was butter, but it was actually, that's the only way they could sell the margarine, so it didn't look anything like butter.
And Doug, there's still a law in restaurants in Wisconsin, right? I mean, I guess you can ask for margarine to be brought, but otherwise what goes on the table has to be butter?
Exactly. Yeah. And again, that was, I believe, tried to, so there was some movement in the legislature 5 or 6 years ago to change that, and it died. So you can get it, margarine, but you're right. You have to ask for it.
All right. Well, you know, the Packers offensive line has to eat something, I guess. So, all right, Doug Moe, so great to talk to you. We're going to keep talking about butter here. Doug Moe is a journalist in Wisconsin. He is, he's absolutely the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for margarine and butter coverage many years running now. So we're lucky to get him. Aline and I are going to take a little break here. So are you. We got some things to tell you during the break, however, so don't stop listening. And then we're going to come back. We're going to talk to you about the resurgence of, for want of a better word, artisanal butter.
Have you ever put butter on a pop tart? If you haven't, then I think you should.
Everybody, come along with us.
Have you ever put butter on a pop tart? It's so freaking good.
Yeah.
Have you ever put butter on a pop tart? If you haven't, then I think you should.
Butter is used in so many religions, but only one religion uses cottage cheese as a sacrament. That would be Episcopalianism. Today's show was produced by Betsy Butter Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Amanda Fish likes a pat on the back. The part of Bill Curry was played by Julia Child. Now that we've clarified butter, get ready for a show about which sex is in the driver's seat of evolution. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, that's coming up. We're working on another Betsy Kaplan show. This is about sort of not necessarily new thinking about Darwinism, but maybe a wrinkle on Darwinism that you haven't heard. About which whether males or females are really in the driver's seat. All right, we're talking about butter right now, and we just mentioned Julia Child. So, Wolfie, I think it may be important to hear Julia Child.
Now, this is not a recipe for when you're planning to diet, because it has to have a lot of butter in the bottom of the pan. Don't use any substitutes, because butter is better.
All right. So we're still with Elaine Kosrova. Her book is Butter, A Rich History. And she's here with me in studio. In just a moment, you're going to meet the president of Vermont Creamery, who is making butter the old-fashioned way. But before we do that, one thing we didn't say during the margarine conversation is that some of this was because of a notion that people had that butter was some kind of major contributor to heart disease, that butter was something that we needed to avoid, Julia Child notwithstanding. Mm-hmm. And as you point out, I think it's hard for me, not having followed this that closely, to understand, as you point out, the degree to which butter is kind of off the hook about that these days.
Yes, because saturated fat is coming off the hook. Mm. It's really, really about the saturated fat that's in butter. That's so-called been the substance thought to be responsible for heart disease. And, you know, this goes back to a theory, a scientific theory that was never actually proven in the 60s and the 70s. But because it intuitively made so much sense, it's been such an easy sell for policymakers, for the public, to believe that, oh, yeah, if I eat fat and solid fat, you know, it becomes solid fat on my body. Body or in my arteries. So you know, it's very much a part of our culture to be afraid of any solid fat. And the science is changing radically and quickly on this. You know, we're understanding actually that the fat in your arteries can come from triglycerides that are the result of eating a lot of sugar and a lot of carbohydrates. And at the time, you know, when the anti-fat theory really got going in the 70s and there was quite a lot of heart disease, no one was looking at the fact that people were eating a lot of margarine with trans fats. There was more smoking, there was more stress, there was more sugar in the diet. There were all these other factors that now we know are at least partly to blame for heart disease. But at the time, they just focused on one single thing, saturated fat. And so butter was demonized, of course, red meat as well.
Mm-hmm. So butter is off the hook a little bit, and also people, as they are turning their attention to things that are made a little bit more carefully. We talked a few segments ago about that, also the sense of things that are alive rather than dead. People are being attracted back to a kind of butter that seems a little bit more like the European kinds, a kind that's more alive than dead. So that is a good way to usher in Adeline Druert, president of Vermont Creamery. She brings her knowledge of butter making to Vermont from her home country of France, where they are experiencing sort of a fake butter shortage, which we already talked about. So first of all, welcome to our conversation, Adeline.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Colin and Elaine.
So tell us how butter is made, the way that you make it. Describe the process.
Absolutely. Well, first, thank you for inviting us in the show. We love talking about cheese, and we certainly love talking about butter. The way we make our butter at Vermont Creamery is, I would call it the traditional way, the way I've learned how to make it in France, which is we receive fresh, high-fat cream from a local co-op. Then we pasteurize this cream, like all butter manufactured in the U.S. And then we start a very critical process called, we call it maturation, which is adding a special selection of starter cultures to the cream and letting those starter culture over time produce compounds, flavors. And that stage of maturation takes about 18 to 20 hours. So it's a very long time, but the key here is to take the time to have enough flavor to be built. So then when we churn then the cream into butter, we have this aromatic flavors, hazelnut taste that have been developed in the butter. So yeah, maturation of the cream and then slowly churn because our butter is 86% butter fat, so it's a higher fat content than most of the American butter. So it takes a longer time for it to reach this high fat.
This seems like a consistent theme in cooking and thinking about food these days, that obviously mass-produced food has to be made as quickly as possible so you can make as much of it as possible so you can get it to as many people as possible. What you're describing is a process which simply requires time, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's like I like to use the analogy of winemaking, and aging wine in barrel for a long amount of time to have time allow the flavor to be developed in the wine. It's, for us, it's the same. It's the same for culturing the cream.
So Elaine is sitting here. I know that you've got three or four different kinds of butter in your kitchen right now. So Elaine, tell us about what kinds of butter you're using these days.
Well, I have a sheep butter I did a tasting not that long ago, so that's my most curious butter I have right now. It tastes very sheepy, but it's actually quite nice when I mix it with standard butter. It gives it a sort of little gaminess that's nice. I also have some Présidente butter that is the big butter from France.
Yeah.
I do like that butter for making pastry. And I have Organic Valley butter. Should I be mentioning all these brands? Is that okay?
I don't care.
I like Organic Valley butter. And I often do have Vermont Creamery butter in my fridge because it's my favorite table butter. I really like Adeline's butter for the table. Mm-hmm. I mean, she would say, yeah, it's great for baking too, but I really like it on the table.
Well, you know, Adeline, one thing that if you cook, and particularly if you sauté, some of us who do a lot of sautéing, well, olive oil is a little bit more attractive to us because we feel as though the butter is going to smoke and burn very quickly. Is your butter different that way? What's it like cooking with this more sort of genuine, historic kind of butter?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, actually, sautéing in a high-fat butter is a great way to be able to work your food that you are trying to cook and caramelize and have the flavor of the butter into the food without having it turning brown. So high-fat butter allows you to be able to saute for a much longer amount of time without burning not only the fat but also the food. Mm-hmm. So it's a great cooking butter, especially for this kind of application.
You know, I was saying to Elaine, Adeline, that I go to a lot of farmers markets around Connecticut, and I very, very rarely see any kind of small batch or artisanal butter. I don't know whether it's because it's so labor intense, but I mean, for every 50 farms or 30 farms making cheese, there's maybe one farm making butter. Why is that? Why is butter not catching up with cheese in quite that way?
I probably because of the yield throughout the supply chain. So for each pounds of cream, you're gonna have it takes 10 pounds of milk, and then you have 9 pounds of skim that you need to do something with it, and then 1 pound of cream gives you half a pound of butter. So when you think of the product, how you start with milk, then you need to turn it into cream and have to figure out what to do with the skim milk. And then from this cream, you're going to have to make butter out of it, and only half of your volume is going to be butter. And then you have to do something with the buttermilk.
So Adeline Duart, thank you so much for spending time with us, the president of Vermont Creamery. We have just a few minutes left with Elaine Kosrova. Her book is Butter, A Rich History. So one of the great things about writing a book like this one is you got a terrific excuse to travel to all kinds of interesting places and see what else people do. So you did experience, you were just talking about sheep butter in your refrigerator, but you've been to Bhutan, you've been to Italy, where the yak and the water buffalo contribute.
Well,
to butter, right?
I went to India, actually.
India. Did I say Italy?
You said Italy. Yeah. I've been to Italy, too.
I have jet lag.
But it's not much of a butter country yet.
No,
I've been to Bhutan. I really wanted to see in my travels sort of the state of butter in the 21st century, the extremes, which I knew were there, but also experience that. And going to Bhutan was really like stepping back in time.
Yeah.
I mean, they make yak butter the same exact way they did 1,000 years ago. I mean, the only difference is people wear fleece now. It was remarkable to see. And it's still like the women are doing all the milking. The women do all the processing. In India, I really wanted to experience water buffalo butter because, again, this is one of the really ancient butters before cows were on the scene.
Right.
And so I went to a tiny village in the north and got to be with a family who they keep a couple of water buffaloes. And you know, the woman, they take the milk, actually. There's no skimming off the cream. They take a whole milk and they inoculate it with bacteria to make yogurt. So they're basically taking yesterday's yogurt. They put some in the whole milk and leave it overnight. It becomes this most delicious yogurt I've ever had. Mm-hmm. You know how water buffalo mozzarella is so much better than regular mozzarella? You know, buffalo mozzarella?
Oh, buffalo mozzarella, yeah.
Buffalo mozzarella.
Yeah.
So in the same way that this yogurt is fantastic, but they actually churn this whole milk yogurt to make their buffalo butter. Their buffalo butter. So that's what I got to see and try with a very unusual style of churning in India, very different than the rest of the world. And that particular butter was really delicious.
We're pretty much going to stop here. We're almost out of time, although there's so much more to say. Although we should, as you're alluding to, yak, water buffalo, sheep, goat, camel, reindeer, anything that gives milk, people try to make butter out of it, right?
Pretty much. Not like human milk doesn't make good butter.
Good.
you know, these ruminants, the category of ruminant animals is pretty big, and they can give you butter.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm really glad that human milk doesn't make good butter, because then Gwyneth Paltrow would be selling it on Goop. talk about Goop. Anyway, we've been talking. So lucky to have Elaine Kosrova here. Her book is Butter, A Rich History. I am confident in saying that we have only, as you might say, skimmed the surface of this topic. If you want to know a lot more about butter, a lot of really interesting things about butter, you should get this book. Or better yet, give it to the butterphilic person in your family as a holiday present. Butter, A Rich History by Elaine Kosrova. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan, whose childhood nickname was Butter, actually. And thanks to her for doing that. We've got a very different kind of show tomorrow, but then that's the way we operate.
Stand with me now. Butter. 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 Butter makes it better, boy. Time to get it turning. Butter. 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 Butter's a breeze to keep the world.
Hey, Pants.
Yeah?
Did you hear the rumor about butter?
No.
Never mind. I better not spread it.
That joke, I can't believe it's not better.
Yeah, it was only margarinally good.
Yeah, I've heard butter.